Okay, so welcome to this session. In this session, we are going to go through the contents of Unit 4 of the course book of this course, Aplicaciones Semánticas de la Lengua Inglesa, Diccionarios y Ontologías. And in this unit, we talk, let me see whether, okay. The title is not correct. The title, as you know, is An Introduction to Lexicography and Lexicology. You can download the PowerPoint, as you know, and any doubts you can ask me now while we are while I am presenting, or afterwards at the end. Okay. In this PowerPoint, there are many links that are very interesting for your studies. This is only additional information, but I really recommend you go through them when you have time or if you have time. So what we are going to see in this session is, as you saw on the contents of the book or of the course, some basic notions related to the writing of dictionaries and everything this entails. Okay, the writing of dictionaries is a very complex procedure, and we are going to see what it is about and also the different semantic applications that we need to handle in order for lexicography to accomplish the work properly. And also we are going to see distinctions between what lexicography is as opposed to lexicology, and the differences also with terminology and terminography, for instance, and the different lexicological, lexicographical, terminological applications, a bit the difference between all of them. Okay, so what is the job of the lexicographer, basically? And why is it different from a lexicologist? Here you have a web page. Unfortunately, in this program, I cannot copy paste and introduce the link, but you can, as I said, check on the PowerPoint and access the link, this interesting link, where there is a small introduction to lexicography and also lexicology. The main difference, we will see later on also, is that, let's say that everything that comes in logi is more related to the science, the theory, and lexicography, everything that has this suffix, graphy, has to do more with the practical application, with the art and crafts, the arts and crafts of the lexicon. Another important difference between lexicography and lexicology is that is in, considered in this page is that in lexicography, which is in fact the art and science of compiling dictionaries, we consider lexical units individually, as we will see, through the process of lemmatization. However, in lexicology, we consider lexical units as part of a whole compendium of other lexical units, and we analyze them as such, as part of a whole conceptual system, lexical system, etc. So we analyze the lexicon more, as I said, not as individual words or as individual lexical items, but as part of a whole compendium. So we will need also the science of lexicology to compile our dictionaries, of course. So basically, as I said, lexicography is considered the science and art of compiling dictionaries. So for lexicography, this scientific part is necessary. The science gives us the method. A science always has a kind of protocol of systematization procedures. And that's what we do in scientific disciplines. Art is more creative, and it includes also some part of creativity. It is included in the compiling of dictionaries. Why? as you will have seen, there are different types of dictionaries. And there is always the when you see a dictionary, if you compare different dictionaries, also online dictionaries, you will see that's why you have a practical exercise in the course, which is comparing an entry in different dictionaries, because there is always differences. And this has to do with the hands of the compiler, of the lexicographer. Some lexicographers create definitions in a slightly different ways, or maybe they give more weight to the synonyms, to including synonyms or to including words in context, or maybe they suggest collocations. Other lexicographers will give more strength to, for instance, the syntactic classification of words, or the grammatical class, or the pronunciation, the derivation, or even the etymology. In some dictionaries there is no etymological information. In other dictionaries there is, etc. So there are some basic parts that the dictionary needs to have, or to be considered an adequate dictionary. But also there is always, you see, differences, and this is part of the element art. Okay, so a bit of history. As you have seen in the book, in the contents, the word dictionary already, so this is a very old science, a very old discipline, because it already started in the 13th century. The word dictionarium was already used in the 14th century, and the first book published under the English title Dictionary was a Latin English dictionary by Sir Thomas Eliot in the 16th century. So, well, Latin was always present. The first translation, as you know, was the translation of the Bible. And apart from this, we have had Latin, the Latin translation, and the Latin English dictionary. So, how did it start? Well, for a medieval scholar, for these years, they collected phrases or diction for the pupils that had to study Latin. Latin is also all these is also the beginning of the grammar translation method in those years. The beginning of the teaching of languages also started in the medieval times with Latin. So, in the medieval times, the purpose of dictionaries was glossing text and employing synonyms. So then, synonyms were very important then. What is the connection between lexicography and linguistic theory? Lexicography, as I said, is the practical application of lexicological theory. But of course, it's closely related to linguistics. It is of paramount importance, as you can understand. He keeps appreciation in 2009 gave already certain principles of lexicographical work. I'm going to give some examples of what each of these principles mean. Okay, what do we mean by each principle? So we can see this in a more simple way. The first principle, reconstructing the pattern of the conceptualizations underlying lexical and grammatical meanings of a given language. This long statement is something very simple, but it is very complex, and it's one of the most biggest challenges in the compilation of dictionaries. It is behind a word, understanding how this word is conceptualized in a specific language, and how this conceptualization has to do with a specific culture and how to express it. This becomes particularly complicated with bilingual or trilingual dictionaries, because as we all know, language is a conceptual phenomenon. We have seen this in previous lessons, in previous units, which means that behind a term, or a lexical item, or a lexical expression, there is a concept behind. This concept is created by a culture, and what is existent in a specific culture does not exist in another culture, or the concept itself differs from one culture to the other. So how do we express it? What is the idea behind a concept? It is important to establish a frame under this culture. For instance, this is also given in previous units, the example, Sirimiri. Well, I wrote Sirimiri. I think it's also written like this. Sirimiri, as you know, it's a specific type of rain that and it's a word used in the Basque Country because it is this type of rain where there are no big drops, but it's like becoming humid, getting humid. It rains, but you don't see the big drops. This type of rain doesn't exist in other parts of the world, so they don't have this word, sirimiri. So if we are going to, for instance, to create a bilingual dictionary, are we going to include this word? How do we establish an explanation, our definition for this concept of sirimiri? Okay, so this is these are questions without answer now. It's just for you to see what we mean by trying to understand the concepts that are underlying a word, a specific word. For instance, we saw in previous units the differences, the different types of bread that exist in France or in Belgium or in the north of Europe, where they have 30 types of names for bread. And in Spain, until very recently, there was only pan de pueblo, sobado, hueco, and that was it. Because that was the bread we had until very recently. So then there is no need to include a word that doesn't have a concept that is not existent in our culture. Now we have more words, of course. Well, the second principle is integrated linguistic description in dictionary entries, so that entries in a dictionary are sensitive to grammatical rules. So this is very simply put, introducing certain indications about the lexical item, the grammatical class of the word, for instance, whether it is a verb, a noun, an adjective, an adverb, a preposition, whether it is a locative particle or a time preposition, whether a verb is transitive, intransitive, this type of information, okay? So this would be the linguistic description, the basic linguistic description we need to include in a dictionary. The third principle is searching for systematicity, of course. What does this mean? In lexicon, as manifested in various classes of lexemes, etc., systematicity is very important, and this is part of the scientific activity. As I said, a scientific discipline always has a system. A system means that we do things according to a specific rules, and we have a kind of protocol. It's like when you will have to do the bachelor's thesis, which is in Spanish trabajo de fin de grado, and then we will show you the different steps, one step by step, of the research work. This is a systematic procedure, and we have to do A, B, C, D, E. Okay? In different types of papers, there are many, maybe more open ways of writing a paper, of creating an academic work, but in general, we have a system, and the same happens with sciences, with pure sciences. For instance, in labs, they will probably have a very strict protocol on how to investigate certain things. So systematicity has to do with this. Something systematic means that it is framed within a specific procedure, and we always carry out the same procedure. Otherwise, we would get crazy when we analyze a dictionary and we see that each word or each item has a different ways of notation, etc. That's why we need systematicity. The fourth principle is emphasizing meticulous studies of separate word senses in all of their linguistically relevant properties. Explained in more simple words, semantic properties that are grammatically relevant. This has to do also with principle two. Welcome, Diego. For instance, the semantic properties of an adjective. We are going to describe this item according to its semantic properties, and these semantic properties will have to do with its lexical class, for instance, whether in this case an adjective has certain properties, which is it goes close to a noun, it modifies, it can modify a noun phrase, or another will modify a verbal phrase, etc. And the last principle, it's no problem. the last principle, which is formulating rules governing the interaction of lexical and grammatical meanings in the text, means, for instance, some basic rules that we need to know in order to understand how a lexical item is included, codified in a dictionary. For instance, whether the rules of synonymy, antonymy, hyperonymy, hyponymy. Hyponymy and hyperonymy are very important in dictionaries. For instance, scarlet is a hyponym of red because it is a type of red. More specific, so among the red color, we have vermilion, scarlet, and other reds. And red, in turn, is also a hyponym of color. It's a type of color, so we will use these lexical interactions to create our entries, to establish our definitions, to establish our word classes, etc. So these principles, translated in a more simple way, as you have seen, are quite simple, but we need to take all of them into account. I guess a lexicographer, after a few practices or years of practice, they do this more or less automatically. But of course, there is a lot of work behind, especially with first principle, with the conceptualization of certain lexical items, especially with bilingual dictionaries, as I said. So another important thing I wanted to highlight was, this is very basic, but it's very important, the difference between lexicology and lexicography, as we have seen at the beginning, and also the difference between terminology and terminography, and also the difference between the first group, lexicology and lexicography, as opposed to terminology and terminography. You probably have already understood this, but just in case, I'm just going to review it. The suffixes logi, as opposed to graphy, have to do with the idea of science. Logi has to do with more with the theory, the theoretical aspects, and graphy has to do more with the arts and crafts or the practical aspects of a discipline. So, for the application lexicography, for lexicography and for terminography, we will need the theoretical aspects that the disciplines of lexicology and terminology study. Lexicology will have to do with the science of the lexicon. It will analyze lexical items in context, in combination with other lexical items, alone, etc. It will create the theoretical framework for that will be later on used by the arts and crafts of lexicography. The same for terminology and terminography. What is the difference between lexicology, lexicography, and terminology, terminography? In the first place, terminography and terminology have to do with a specific lexicon, what we call language for specific purposes. A term is a specialized lexical item that belongs to a specific field. For instance, the terminology of aircrafts, aircraft terminology. If we are going to translate a handbook or an instruction, a manual for piloting a plane, for instance, or a helicopter, we need specific terms. This will be part of the science of terminology, and also a terminographer will be the one compiling these terms. It has a semasiological approach. We have seen before that onomasiological and semasiological approaches, in the end, are combined with each other, so they are not independent from each other, but it has to do more with how where we put the emphasis and the focus. In a semasiological approach, we go from the term to the concept. So we first focus on the terms. So which are the terms used in this field? We compile the terms, and then we try to give them a definition, a meaning, a sense. We try to identify the concepts that are behind these terms. But what is important is the terms, the compilation of the terms. I mean, it's not the most important over the concepts. What I mean is that that's how we start, first from the term and then to the concepts. In the onomasiological approach that is the part of the lexicographical work, or in lexicology, we also focus on the concepts themselves. So we see, for these specific concepts, what are the terms used? What are the words used for a specific concept? So we are more focused on the meaning, on the contents behind words. Okay. We go now to the third point, which is meaning in dictionary entries. This is the main point of today. Sorry, I'm going to. I thought I had switched off my phone. We are going to see the difference between dictionaries, thesauri, and glossaries. Probably you know already, but we are going to just review it. The most important is to distinguish between a thesaurus and a dictionary and a glossary. Because dictionaries and glossaries have similarities, let's say. A thesaurus, well, as I said, Diego, before that you were not still here, the PowerPoint that you can download includes links. This is a link, but here I cannot access the link, but I include it so that you can already navigate through the links, or later on when you have the time. There are different links in the PowerPoint that are very interesting and very useful. What is a thesaurus? There are many definitions for a thesaurus. What is important is a thesaurus is organized according to a concept, a semantic area. So words are grouped together which are similar in meaning. Whereas in a dictionary we have words, and in a glossary they are organized alphabetically. So this is the main difference. In a thesaurus, they are associated through semantic relationships. The semantic relationships are, as Aitchison and associates point out, equivalence, hierarchies, associations. This can be, for instance, a hierarchical can be hyponyms and hyperonyms. Associations can be, for instance, feelings, emotions. Positive emotions maybe are associated with the idea of happiness, or maybe with the idea of money. And negative emotions can be associated with the idea of death or loss, or stress, for instance, work. So this can be also associations. This is also something very, it's a trend nowadays. Sentiment analysis, for instance, is based on this type of association. Sentiment analysis, there are nowadays programs where you can do text mining, and then you can see what is the most, the associations certain words have. For instance, I was in the conference I was talking about before, which is the annual conference of the Spanish Linguistics, Applied Linguistics Association, AESLA. Some colleagues from the University of Malaga did a very interesting investigation about the connections we made of happiness. So what are the through a corpus they analyzed, and they used I can write them down also in the forum later on, that you can investigate the applications. I don't remember now the type of applications, but they are available on the web. To analyze the disassociative relationships, the words that we use more that we relate to happiness. And some words appear in different conceptual areas. For instance, the idea of precisely satisfaction appears with the area of consumption, surprisingly, in a consumer society as we have, with the idea of having money. Apparently, having money, consuming things, new things also appear, new things or new experiences are also associated to happiness. This is, for instance, something related to associations, okay? In a dictionary and in a glossary, the list is alphabetical. We will see now more on dictionaries. The difference between a dictionary and a glossary is that a glossary is just a selection of words that appear in a specific area, and a dictionary will include all the words of a language. But in a glossary, for instance, you have in the course book, it's just an example, and you have glossaries in many other specialized works, which is selecting the terms that have appeared in a specific word and listing them alphabetically at the end of the work, and then including a definition. So it's a selection of words according to a specific conceptual area. Here you have also examples of thesaurus, and in an interesting one that I like very much is this visual thesaurus, because here you also see already these associations that I mentioned in a visual way. And nowadays, with the advance of technologies and the tendency we have in society to become more cognitively focused on the visual, there are a lot of semantic applications that are tending to this, not only with thesauri, also terminologies, conceptual databases, etc. So as I said, the glossary is a restricted type of dictionary. Here you have examples of digital glossaries, a collection of glossaries in this link, and also online bilingual and multilingual dictionary resources. We have finally the types of dictionaries. We have two types of dictionaries, basically linguistic dictionaries, which are the prototypical dictionaries, which are general purpose dictionaries. Normally, these prototypical dictionaries are monolingual, although, as you know, we can also have bilingual dictionaries, especially for language learning purposes, but it's also for translation purposes and interpreting purposes. And terminological dictionaries, which are specific areas of knowledge. This has to do with terminology and terminography. In terminography, they will design terminological dictionaries, which are also called, as we said, language for specific purposes dictionaries. For instance, a dictionary on law, a law dictionary, or an economics dictionary, or a fashion dictionary, for instance. And there are different types also according to other criteria. For instance, a time perspective, we have diachronic and synchronic dictionaries. Diachronic dictionaries are less frequent, but they are also very interesting. For instance, in the study of the history of the English language, we have the Oxford, the Old English Dictionary, the Bosworth and Toller. We also have synchronic dictionaries of a specific period in time, for instance, Middle English dictionaries. Also, there are differences according to how entries are treated, how we arrange the entries, how we visualize an entry, how we arrange it. That's what we were saying before. This is part of the arts and crafts of designing a dictionary. That's why not all dictionaries are the same, and we will choose dictionaries according to our purposes or to how we like them. That's why sometimes we say, oh, I prefer the Oxford Dictionary because in the Oxford Dictionary the definitions are better, or I prefer a Longman Dictionary because they give diachronic explanations and they give also etymological information, and in this other dictionary, or things like this, you know. And also, linguistic level dictionaries means that, for instance, we have dictionaries that are related to, they focus more on the use of certain words. We have, for instance, the Maria Moliner in Spanish, which is a dictionary that has to do with the uses of Spanish, if I'm not mistaken. And also the grammar. It gives grammar rules, etc., which is handy for instance, well, Spanish translators, Spanish philologists, or people who teach Spanish. They can be updated through this type of dictionaries. And finally, as I said, there are monolingual or bilingual dictionaries. Bilingual dictionaries are less common, but of course they are also very, very important, especially they're very important when we start learning a language. Online bilingual dictionaries, we have a lot. Word Reference, Lingua is a corpus-based bilingual dictionary because it also establishes frequencies of collocation. I don't know if you have seen Lingua. It's a very, very good one. Now we are going to continue with compiling entries, the different entries in a dictionary. To create an entry, we have to focus on a process called lemmatization. And this process is organized as follows. First, the headwork or lemma. We establish what is the lemma. We mark it normally in a different way from the rest of the words, or we make it with a special font, or we put a specific a bold or italics or bigger. Then you will have the pronunciation. This is the prototype, but as I said, you can find different types of dictionaries, and you have probably put that into practice. We have the pronunciation with phonological and sometimes even phonetic and sometimes even phonological notation, the word class, the part of a speech, the etymology, which is not always present, the definition, and the citations, so examples in use, how it is used, this word in context, which is very handy when we are learning a language, for instance. At least it was very useful for me. We are going to see here just an example, since I cannot enter the links, but you can. In Oxford Learners Dictionaries, this webpage includes many, many types of dictionaries. This is the Advanced Language Dictionary. And as you see, for instance, not only does it include the lemma, it also gives an indication of the level of the word according to the language learning level, which is a new type of information that was not applicable 20 years ago, but now it's starting to be used, which is quite interesting. Then we have the digital dictionaries have the big advantage that not only we have the phonetic symbols, which sometimes for the layman are not understandable, but also we can click on the icon and listen to the pronunciation. It gives grammatical information of the form, for instance, morphological information. This is the plural form of man, men. There is also here idioms, which is a characteristic that was not included in Halliday's classification, as you can see. And then the definition, the first, when we have several definitions or several meanings, as you know, we have one, two, three, etc., and the word in context. The good thing of the digital dictionaries is that they include also a lot of information, which was also present in non-digital dictionaries, is still present, of collocations or expressions that are used, well, collocations, collocational information of this specific word, for instance, what best man means, men's room, leading man, etc., which is best man has a meaning in itself. That's why it is called a collocation. But it's also directly is much easier to navigate through a digital dictionary because we can click here and then we go directly to this item. When we are in a paper dictionary, we need to go through the paper, etc. Also, in any case, it's a matter of taste, whether we are more analogical or digital. But as you see, digital dictionaries have include nowadays different types of information, additional information to the basic types of information that we have. Here, for instance, there is no etymological information. Going through this point of the course text, which is the difference between meaning definition and dictionary definition. It is just for you to go through it quickly because it's not so important, but it is essential is that we distinguish that there are these two types of definitions. What is the difference between a dictionary definition and a meaning definition? A meaning definition is normally the way linguists in the past, let's say 40, 50, 60 years, have tried to establish meaning definitions in order to create a system to understand the semantic underlying the phenomena of languages. That's why we have, and you have seen this in the course semantics and probably in the course syntax, we have different linguistic theories, generative grammar, functional grammar, cognitive grammar, role and reference grammar, structural grammars, etc. And all of them try to deal with this meaning definition. They create a notational apparatus, a way of defining not only words, but also clauses or sentences. They try to understand the underlying semantic mechanisms within these linguistic expressions. And they all use different, which is, for me, I understand, it's like the government when they implement a new law and then the new government comes and implements another new law. Instead of trying to play with the same law or improve it, they just take out the previous law and they create a new law. Well, this is the same. They all try to create their own notational apparatus, their own symbology, and we all, the linguists or the people who study languages, we need to learn how this notational apparatus works again and again. Sometimes it is useful and interesting because they focus on different areas of language. For instance, as you know, cognitive grammar focuses on metaphors, metonymies, the figurative mechanisms of language. Functional grammar and role and reference grammar focus more on the conceptualization of language. Generative grammar is more focused on the underlying structures of language, which is more syntactic. So we can understand in a way that they have notational apparatuses. But this type of meaning and making sense of language, that the final aim in all kinds of notational apparatuses is to make it cross-linguistic, is very different from a practical application of a definition such as in dictionary definition. In a dictionary definition, there is a more or less conventionalized conceptualization of an item. We all agree, for instance, that red is a color, that it's a type of color, let's say. This would be a definition, or man is a male person. We all agree on this. We create simple definitions that are conventionalized and that help us understand the meaning of that word. It's much more, let's say, down to earth. Okay, that's the difference between a dictionary, the definition in a dictionary, and understanding meaning through linguistic disciplines. And finally, we're to the point of dictionary writing and corpus annotation. Why do we have this section? Because we need corpora to write a dictionary, to compile a dictionary. This is a very interesting, Nick. This word corpora in the PowerPoint, it goes to a link, which is englishcorpora.org. In this word, in this link, you have a lot of English corpora. One of my favorites for my research purposes has been the COCA corpus, which is the contemporary corpus of American English. But now it has been by far superseded by other types of corpora with the emergence of the digital era. We have the British National Corpora Corpus and the COCA corpus have become not obsolete, but very like a plain dwarf against the giant. There are corpora that have billions of words and expressions, etc. So giant corpora, which incorporate amazing amount of data. Because they are, as we saw in previous units, they are compiled not only by humans, as the previous corpora, the traditional corpora, but also there are mechanisms, machine compilations of corpora. Although we always need, and nowadays still, we will need always the human review, but it's not necessary, for instance, for this type of compilations. What are the main characteristics of a corpus? Well, text encoding and annotation. It means that a corpus is enhanced with different types of linguistic information. Depending on the type of corpus we will have and the purposes of that corpus, we will have different ways of tagging the information that we have in this corpus for our purposes. So this annotation has different formats. Okay, so by now there are no agreed ways of representing information in texts, but there is a tendency towards standardization. One standard, more or less standard practice is known as COCOA reference. COCOA was an early computer program that was used for, so it's an ancient one, was used for extracting indexes of words in context from machine readable texts. Its conventions were carried forward into several other programs, for instance, the Oxford Concordance programs or the Longman-Lancaster corpus and the Helsinki corpus, which are the very famous and the oldest corpora, oldest compared to the nowadays amount of corpora that we have. So it's a way of standardizing corpora, not annotation in corpora. Here we have some examples of how the COCOA reference can be used, although nowadays there are many corpora that don't apply this type of annotation. But it's good for you to know, to see some examples. For instance, these angle brackets to include, for instance, an author's name was used with these angle brackets, for instance. Today, this is a very interesting thing. There is always a tendency for a formal standardization, as I said, and the most popular project was and is still the Text Encoding Initiative, which was a very highly sponsored project. It tries to implement standardized implementations for machine-readable text interchange. This would make it incredibly fast, incredibly economic as regards data management, and has made it in the semantic web. It has been especially of paramount importance. This TEI, the Text Encoding Initiative, uses a form of document markup, which is known from the very beginning, a standard generalized markup language. The standard generalized markup language, a typical one is the HTML that we all know. Okay, that's how it started. And in this link, you have some tutorials about this. It explains in very simple words how this all began with the HTML language and this text encoding initiative. Let's see some types of annotation that we can find in Corpora. First of all, tagging. Tagging is what we will call annotation. Annotation and tagging is almost the same. Tagging including certain tags. Okay? And we can include tagging can be sometimes be used as a synonym of annotation, and sometimes is used as a more specific type of annotation, because with tags we include special codes which indicate particular features. But for instance, the second part of a speech annotation is also named. You will find information on this on the web by clicking on writing part of a speech tagging. So in this sense, as I said, there is a tendency to use interchangeably tagging and annotation. Part of a speech annotation is the most basic one, which is just including information about the lexical item for disambiguation purposes. For instance, it's not the same drive as a noun and drive as a verb. So for disambiguation purposes, it's interesting to include this syntactic type of information. Okay. Already in the 80s, the UCREL team at Lancaster University reported a 95% rate using the program CLOSS. CLOSS is still in use nowadays with this part of a speech tagging. Lemmatization, all these types of annotation can be present one type or all of them at the same time or two of them. It depends on the corpus. Lemmatization is the one that, as we saw, we use in dictionaries. We need to find the word form, the head word form. This will be the lemma. And how we distinguish a lexeme from a lemma, because a lexeme is kind of the abstract idea of this group of variants, of this group of lexemes that compose the whole lexeme. So for kick, we have kicks, kicked, kicking. This is the whole lexeme with all these lexical items. And the head word will be the word form, the form that we will use to, for instance, compile a dictionary and also to put in a corpus. We have computer programs that can do this, and they are called lemmatizers. So this has already become computerized. Wait, because I don't see in this. I need parsing. Parsing is a very frequent type of annotation. What does it do? Parsing is very important with terminology and terminography, especially. Parsed corpora are also called tree banks because they make phrase markers. It has to do with word frequency, and it establishes morphosyntactic categories into relationships. For instance, the semantics of morphological relations, describing meanings that are added when a verb becomes a noun, it gives a lot of information. For instance, you have the verb keep, kick. In the simple sentence, he kicked it. Does not indicate how many times he kicked it. So the verb does not codify the category of quantity, but quantity in this case is a semantic feature of a noun. So in a parser, we will see these semantic features or syntactic features of semantic entities implemented to the specific category. For instance, in this case, quantity would be excluded from the semantic parsing of a verb. So it's like giving syntactic information of lexical items. And then semantic annotation. Semantic annotation can be done with different symbols. There is an example included in the book. For instance, a low content word, it has a lot of numbers, all null numbers. Plant life in general, and then they include numeric annotation. So it semantic annotation would include conceptualizations, semantic information such as clothing, parts of the body of certain semantic areas or conceptual areas. Well, this I will go through quickly because it's in the book. It was just to mention, I wanted to mention that this was already done in the 90s. It was used by Schmidt, and he used it to create hierarchical structures to analyze language, semantic relationships, etc. And it can be applied to the semantic web. To be used by computers. It could be also a type of ontological annotation, and it will be for sure used in the designing of ontologies. And there are different semantic annotation models, as I said. One of them is the use of digits, of numbers. And finally, we have discourse annotation. Discourse annotation is not so common, but we can also find some corpora. For instance, in Spanish, we have El Corpus del Español Hablado, where we include tags or annotation related to discourse categories. In this case, for instance, the London Lund Spoken Corpus included already in the 80s 16 discourse tags. For instance, apologies, greetings, hedges. It can be related. It can be very useful for discourse analysis. And we will use anaphoric annotation in this case. Anaphoric annotation can be related to discourse annotation, but it can also be independent from discourse annotation. Anaphoric annotation can be done through the use of pronouns, repetitions, substitutions, everything that has to do with cross references in a text, either whether it is oral or written text. We have the IBM anaphoric device or the Lancaster anaphoric device. This has been less common by now, as I said, because it's more difficult to compile, but nowadays with the advances of the digital technologies, nothing is so difficult anymore. And finally, we have collocations and pragmatic annotation, and collocations are very important in the corpora because it has to do with frequency, and frequency is very, very common, and it has been analyzed recently a lot in the last 20 years. We have also Wordsmith Tools, which is a concordance program. I have included also here in this PowerPoint, and also we have in the course book, but in this PowerPoint also, different concordance programs and alignment programs. These concordance programs are very handy, for instance, for translation studies and also for terminological database. Here I just included two screenshots, because as I said, I cannot enter the links that I gave you. But it's just to give you an example of the amount of corpora, and this is just the beginning of the web page. If you go through it, you will see that there are many more corpora. And you see here, for instance, the biggest corpora is called News on the Web Now, and it has 15 billion text, words. It has, it includes 20 countries, and it's only from the past 12 years. The intelligent web-based corpus, which is the second biggest corpus, it's 14 billion words. It's based on the web. So, as you can see, the COCA corpus before was taken from some newspapers, magazines, etc. Nowadays, with the web, you can see the incredible amount of texts and words we have. If we compare it to, for instance, the last one, the TV corpus or the movie corpus, we have 325 million words or 200 million words. It's elaborated from movies and from TV shows. So the amount of knowledge we have produced in, you see here, from the 50s or the 30s to the to 4 years ago when it stopped being the compilation finished. This means that in the past 70 years of producing TV shows, compiling words, imagine the difference, which is in 70 years, 320 million words have been compiled compared to the past 12 years, 15 billion words. So the internet has changed the amount of data we handle, obviously. As I said, this is some instructions that we have in this webpage. They suggest how to use the corpora even. They are facilitating instructions for the layman to use the corpora. These corpora are used by all kinds of enterprises, users, linguists, but also educational purposes, commercial purposes, etc. We can look for a frequency list, which is, as I said, one of the most frequent uses of corpora. You can search by individual words, but you can see collocations, clusters, topics, concordance lines. You can look also, you can search for phrases and strings, almost sentences, and you can find random words or find the word of the day. So this is just four suggestions on how to use corpora. And finally, just to finish with, here I have included a very useful link, which is called Corpus Analysis. In this link, you have 266 tools. Every year, this website gets more and more updated with new tools. In fact, here, as you can see, you can suggest a new tool and make suggestions, corrections. This is the web, the semantic web nowadays, 3.0, la web 3.0, is this. This is a clear example of the semantic web, how we are in a moment of all contributing to the web and even suggesting corrections, changes, etc. If you are going to do your bachelor thesis, your master's thesis, your thesis, in here you could find all kinds of tools to do corpus linguistics, but you can also, you can find concordance, collocations, visualizations, taggings, everything you want. And finally, for terminological databases, they are interested in these databases that are officially, let's say, the most institutional, because they have been developed. The first one, UNTERM or UNTERM. UNTERM is the United Nations Terminology Database. The IAT Europa is the terminology database created by the European Union. And then you have MemoQ or Term Sciences, which are also very interesting data, terminological databases with also sometimes visual information. So that was everything by now. And now if you want to make any questions, you can do them now or use the forum. Thank you for watching till here. So if you have any questions.